When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
What's up, everyone? It's Oliver. This is our first episode back in over a month, and today we've got a very special guest joining us.
Hey, guys. It's Braden here. Today's guest isn't on time. Time is on him. We're sitting down with R.T. Custer, the founder and CEO of Vortic Watches, a brand that's not just making watches, but preserving American history through innovation and craftsmanship. RT, thank you for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course, man. I really want to dive into a lot today. I want to talk about watches, even like diving into like how they're made. That's something I'm curious about. I'm also very curious about the business side of things. I just want to start off with the history of Vortic Watches. How did this start and what was the inspiration behind it?
Yeah, so my business partner, co-founder, and friend Tyler and I had the idea on the golf course after school one day at Penn State. We were both studying. I was studying engineering and he was studying math. And he was wearing a watch on the golf course. And I was asking him, like, why? And, you know, why was he so into watches? And I found his fascination in watches fascinating just to me. And so we kind of just spent like the whole round of golf talking about watches and like why people buy them and why people invest so much of them. And one of the big questions we had was, why are all watches made in Switzerland or China? Why are watches not made in America? And that conversation was probably 14 years ago. And about 10 years ago, we left school, we started our own careers, and we just couldn't get that idea out of our head. And we went down that rabbit hole trying to answer the question of why can't we make a watch in America? And so we tried, we did a ton of research, and we discovered the history of American watchmaking, which started in the late 1800s, making pocket watches in America, basically like, you know, that late 1800s to mid 1900s. America was the Switzerland of the world, and there was amazing watch companies making millions of pocket watches back then. And just like we all carry around an iPhone today, back then, if you're in like 1920, the only two ways you could tell time were a clock or a pocket watch. And so millions of these pocket watches were around. Fast forward to today, nobody has any use for pocket watches. They get scrapped for the gold and silver of the case, and the little engine that's inside that tells time is basically trash. And we had the light bulb moment of like, hey, what if we upcycled those old pocket watches, turned them into wristwatches? We would be, you know, the only 100% American made watch. It'd be a cool piece of history on the wrist, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that's where the idea for Vortic came from, like Vortex and TikTok, a beautiful clash of old and new. That's where Vortic comes from.
Okay.
Oh, wow. That's innovative. That's cool.
That was one of our questions. So that's good.
Dang. Yeah. So that's Vortic.
Do you find it easy to locate these pocket watches? Because like you said, I mean, they're from late 1800s, mid 1900s. Like, I'm sure a ton of them are destroyed or just very difficult to find. Like, where are you finding these?
Yeah, so I buy them through estate auctions. Long story short, every day somewhere in America, a jewelry store, a pawn shop, or something like that goes out of business, and they have a whole bunch of pocket watches in the back that, you know, they forgot about. And they make their way to these liquidation, you know, estate sales and auctions, and nobody has any use for pocket watches, and most of them were already scrapped, like the pawn shop, you know, ripped the inside out, and they melted down the gold or the silver, the outside case, and just the guts of the pocket watch was left, and maybe somebody felt bad, you know, throwing it away because it is a piece of history, and it's like a little engine in there. And so there's just boxes of pocket watches laying around that people have no idea what to do with. And I buy all of them. You know, if it's an American pocket watch, I buy as many as I can from those liquidation, you know, estate sales and all that. And then my watchmakers and I go and sort through them and sift through them. We find the, you know, coolest ones and the ones that we can restore. And I buy probably 2,000 or 3,000 pocket watches a year in order to make about 300 wristwatches a year for Vortic. So you're getting only the best of the best. And to answer your question, I mean, there's millions of pocket watches made, so yeah. I don't see any reason I can't keep buying a few thousand a year to keep doing this upcycling.
For sure. So especially at the 300.
Yeah. Are you taking bits and pieces of each watch and kind of like would you take like a gear from one watch and combine it into another one, or do you pretty much keep it like the same watch, just kind of like put a wristband on it?
Yeah. So our mission is to preserve American history. And so for the most part, all of them are original. It's the same, face. We call it the dial or the face of the watch, the same hands, the same gear system that's inside. And everything stays together throughout the whole process. And so we try to keep everything as original and all original as we possibly can. Sometimes we have to, kill one to save another, basically, right? And in that way, it's really cool because back then, 100 years ago, they had to make it the right way the first time. They didn't have time to spare. They couldn't make extra parts. Nobody could afford to do that. I mean, they barely had electricity in the early 90s. So it's really interesting to think about. They made these things to last a lifetime, and they do. They can be restored and fixed up. You don't have to make, new parts, or, fast forward to today, we live in the throwaway economy, right? When your iPhone dies, you just throw it away and buy a new one.
Right.
At this point, like 100 years ago, that wasn't a thing. You had to make things that could be fixed and fixed up. So that's honestly the fun part, is like restoring them and trying to keep it all original.
Yeah. Like when you think about it, it's like these historic watches would be more expensive than like a Rolex. Like it's probably better quality. You know what I mean? Like back in the day, like it's built to last. You know what I mean? Even cars built to last, like back in the day. Now it's like you said, it's like the iPhone. Everybody just throws it away. Like I've heard they purposely actually like run down the iPhone, so you have to buy a new one or whatever. It's just
there's
crazy.
A term for that. I think it's planned obsolescence, and that's a new term. Nobody had the bandwidth to be able to do
that. Makes total sense.
But for the iPhone, that's a real thing. They want it to die in your hands after 2 or 3 years, so you buy a new one. Same thing with most modern technology. That's what's good for business and the shareholders.
So you have an engineering background. Are you the one that actually restores these? And you said you have other watchmakers. How do you locate people that have expertise in like a pocket watch? I feel like that's maybe a dying art.
Yeah. So zooming out, that whole problem is called the skilled trade gap. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Mike Rowe, the dirty jobs guy.
Yeah.
But that's what he talks about all the time is, you can make just as much today as a plumber, an electrician, as you can, with somebody like me as a 4-year engineering degree. You can go to trade school for a year or two and come out and make just as much and work with your hands. Mm-hmm. All of the skilled trades are dying industries, and it's sad, but watchmaking is just the same. The average age of an American watchmaker is approaching 70 years old. So to find people that can do what I need, which is restoring an old pocket watch, it's not just fixing a Rolex, it's much, much more difficult, is very, very hard. It's hard to find them. And so the way I do it is I just try to run a really cool business. I want to be a fun person to work for. To answer your question, I studied engineering, but I'm not a watchmaker. I think that's a whole nother level of engineering. I'm just the idea guy. I'm an entrepreneur. I get to spend most of my life in front of the camera like this, or, building big ass spreadsheets and managing the money for the business and making sure we don't run out. But I keep finding really cool people that love, American history. They love watchmaking. They love restoring these things. And thankfully, I don't need very many of them. But to make 300 watches a year, I need 3 or 4 really great watchmakers that can make a couple watches a day and restore a few pieces and keep up with our workload. And they sit right beside me, like right through this wall here, and they're just making watches.
Awesome. Yeah. So are you in your warehouse right now? /office?
Yeah. So my office in the corner of the warehouse, we have 8,500 square feet here in Fort Collins, Colorado. About a third of the shop is manufacturing. We're big CNC machines. We're cutting the metal to make the parts. And then a third of it is a clean room where we actually do the watch restoration and assembly and, keep the dust out of that room. So we're putting it all together. And then the rest of it is office space and, a little showroom that we have here.
Awesome. Do you guys own or rent that? I'm just like a real estate guy. Just curious.
Yeah. Yep. So I personally own this building and then I lease it back to the company, which is what my investors and all my real estate and financial advisors told me to do.
Awesome. You're in a good spot there.
Yep. It's the American dream, man. It's fun. Yeah. I own the building, the land underneath us, and I don't have a landlord to come and tell me what I can and can't do. We're just making watches and living the dream.
Yeah. Awesome. I don't want to jump the gun here, but have you thought about what the company would do because it's just facts that like there's not always going to be pocket watches being made. I mean, they don't even really I'm not sure if you said they're not really even making them anymore original. So it's like, what happens theoretically if you ran out of pocket watches to redesign into wristwatches? Would you consider making an original piece?
Yeah. So two ways to answer that. From a, in my lifetime, we are not going to run out of old pocket watches to find and restore. There were so many made that even if like 0.1% of them were still around, my business model at 300-ish watches a year would still be good. And from my perspective, that's a really cool thing. Like, I make art. Like, yes, they're wristwatches and they function and they tell time, but they're conversation pieces and they're one of a kind and they're made in low quantities. And so I charge based on the rarity of every single piece. And so most people perceive what you perceive, which is mildly accurate, that we can only make so many and there we may run out someday. And so the price has continuously gone up every month and every year since I started the company 10 years ago, which is really cool. And so for my customers, like, they're buying an appreciating asset, you know, 5 years from now, their Vortic watch that they own is probably worth more than it is when they bought it. It is now for sure for the people that bought it 5 years ago. And then the other way is I'm building more than just a Vortic watch company, which is, you know, 300 watches a year made from old pocket watches. I have Vortic Inc., which is the backbone of American watch manufacturing. So we are cutting all the metal to make all the parts of these watches here. But we also started a second brand called Colorado Watch Company, where now I can make thousands of watches, hopefully thousands of watches a month. I mean, I can do what the Swiss do over in Switzerland, but do it here in Colorado. And so Colorado Watch Company is the most American-made watch at scale. And we made 300 watches last month. We'll make 500 watches next month. And we're scaling that brand up. But over time, I plan to either acquire or start other brands and manufacture watches in America at scale for, you know, hopefully 5 or 10 different brands at many different price points and lots of different scales.
Yeah, dude, that's cool. Yeah, we were looking at the website and stuff, and I like how it's kind of like the backbone, like you said. It's kind of like underneath it all, like the powerhouse behind it, and you got that going for you, which is pretty insane. And I also like your business model. It's a little bit different than, like, as far as the Vortic watches go, it's like an art, like you said. It's like an artist, they sell their paintings when they create a new one. You create a watch a day and then you sell it and they're individual, you know what I mean? And they all have like a special, like, idea behind them and story, which I think is very attractive to a lot of buyers. And it's actually very impressive. When you go and buy these watches, how do you know, like, how do you know how much to spend on them? And, like, how do you know the rarity of them? And then do you have an idea in your head, like, how much you're going to sell it for afterwards?
Yeah, that's the most fun part of my job. And I think the whole company is buying the pocket watches. It's like Christmas morning here in the shop when I come back with hundreds of pocket watches and we lay them out on one of the tables and we all go through them and we pick it out and we say, like, oh, cool, look at this one. Or I've never seen one like this. I've personally seen tens of thousands of American pocket watches. And so I can look at one and within 30 seconds, I can tell you within about 10 years of when it was made and probably how rare it is, just because I've seen so many. But the cool thing is, if you look on the back of an old pocket watch, there's a serial number. Whichever company, there was 10 companies that made them. Hamilton was probably the most famous. They were in Pennsylvania. But you have Hamilton, Waltham, Elgin, Illinois. Regardless of the company and where it was made in America 100 years ago, they all put serial numbers on the back of them. That's a unique number. And then there's a database. It's a public, it's a nonprofit. I think it's pocketwatchdatabase.com. And so if you have, like, grandpa's pocket watch and you want to know how old it is and how rare it is, how much it might be worth, you can type that serial number in and it'll say, well, they made 500,000 of that model, or they made 200,000 of this model. Some of them, they made like 500 only ever in 1912. No way. And so those ones are super rare.
Yeah.
And to answer your question, I know based on that rarity, how much it's worth to me and how much it's worth. They're kind of a commodity. So how much it's worth in general to, like, pocket watch collectors and stuff. And then I know how much more I can charge for that one because of how rare either the movement is or how rare the dial is, right? So in the watch industry, you call it the movement, all the gears and springs that tell time. And these are pocket watches that are manually wound. So you have to wind them up every 24 to 36 hours. Otherwise, they'll die. There's no batteries. It's just gears. Modern day, like a Rolex, an Omega, you know, a high-end modern watch, they're automatic. They're mechanical. It's all gears. There's no batteries. But they're automatic, meaning when I move my wrist around, it's going to give it power. It's going to wind it up, and I don't have to like actually interact.
So that's what the watch winder's for.
Exactly.
Like, sits in your closet. I was like, what the heck is that? Why is it moving? Yeah.
Yep. So that's automatic watches. Those have rotors on the back that spin as you move. That technology came out in the 1950s and was prolific by the 60s and 70s. And then in the 1970s, there was what the watch industry called the quartz crisis, where quartz movements came out. And a quartz movement is, it has a battery. It's much cheaper. And that's what all your, I would say if a watch is less than $500, it has a battery in it, it's quartz, you don't have to wind it, there's not a whole lot of gears in it. Mm-hmm. You just, if it dies, you replace the battery, or it's inexpensive enough that you throw it away and you buy a new one. If it's, you know, high hundreds or thousands of dollars, traditionally it's going to have, you know, an automatic or a mechanical movement in it. And so for Vortec Watch Company, they're all 100-year-old pocket watches. None of that technology existed. You have to wind them once or twice a day, which is honestly kind of fun and like therapeutic and different. It really takes you back. And those watches, you know, we charge $3,000 to $10,000 a piece for those watches. Colorado Watch Company, my modern brand, we can make thousands of them. Those are modern automatics. So those wind as you move. Mm-hmm. And those are in the, you know, over time, I'm going to be in the like $1,000 to $2,000 price point until I come out with a quartz or a battery powered one. That'll be hundreds of dollars instead of thousands. So that's just, you know, some general, like how watches are valued.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, going back to the sourcing of the pocket watches and all that stuff, it's in general, buy low, sell high.
Right.
And also their art, right? And so each and every one has a different story and a different price.
On that note of rarity, what's the Patek, the AP, the Rolex of an old pocket watch? Like, what's the best one? What are the collectors looking for? Or like, what's the one that if you found, you'd be like the most hyped about?
Or like if you iced out like a Hamilton from like the 1800s or something.
Would that be? I mean, there people do that mostly to Rolexes. So Rolex and Patek made pocket watches back then.
Wow.
We don't use them because we focus on the American brands. So, you know, everything I do is made in USA or as American as possible. So that's generally outside of our scope. Plus, in the early 90s, Rolex and Omega and Patek, the whole Swiss watch industry in that time, 100 years ago, was what we call the cottage industry, where every watch was like handmade by one watchmaker start to finish, which is awesome. It means it's really valuable. But also, if you drop that watch and break it, you are totally out of luck because there's no spare parts. You can't easily fix it. You need that watchmaker that fixed it the first time to fix it again. And that's, like we talked about, a really hard thing to find is a really great watchmaker. And so for us, we use the American movements because Waltham and Elgin and Ball and Hamilton, those old American watch brands, they were making millions of pocket watches. So if you ever drop your Vortec watch and break it, I can fix it fairly easily and for, you know, hundreds of dollars instead of the thousands it would cost you to send an old Patek pocket watch to get fixed. So for my, just the sustainability of my business and to really protect my customers' investments, we only use and we only make things that we can fix and we can service. Forward. To get back to your question though, there's some amazing, you know, high-end pocket watches. The real, like, the collectability of pocket watches depends on if they're all original. So I don't use many that are that valuable because they're still in their solid gold or solid platinum pocket watch case with the whole cover and the big chain, and you know, they're beautiful. They should stay pocket watches. And they have lots of complications, like calendars, and there's chimes, you know, that they built into old pocket watches, and they have things like fusées, which is hard to explain, but it's like a tiny chain that's inside the watch. I don't even know how they made it 100 years ago, but basically tiny little handmade things that add a lot of rarity and value to old pocket watches. And then there's some cool ones, like, you know, they were all serial numbered. And so like Waltham was one of the big companies. Rockford was another one. Someone found the first couple. So I think Waltham serial number 2, like the second watch that company ever made, is in the Smithsonian Museum because it's so, it's worth probably millions. And I think serial number 3 was auctioned off for charity for hundreds of thousands. And so if you have one of the first ones to a pocket watch collector, that's a lot of value. For me, the most valuable ones and the ones that I get excited about are what I have on my wrist. We call this the military edition. So this pocket watch, it's a true 24-hour dial, which means that, you know, it takes a full 24 hours to have the hour hand move all the way around the face of the watch, which is really rare. You don't see that often on any modern watches at all.
Wait, really?
And it's because this pocket watch was made for the United States Army Air Corps, what became the Air Force, just during World War II. And so this pocket watch that I have on my wrist and everything we use in the military edition, it was made for the navigators on bombers, on the like the B-17 bombers in World War II. And it was how they figured out where they were in the sky. So you, before GPS, you had to know what time it was in order to know where you were. And they used these pocket watches made in Pennsylvania by Hamilton back then to make sure we were bombing Nazi Germany instead of, you know, our allies in different countries.
Wow.
And
it's crazy to me that all that was like, cool. Like was like making sure it went okay was just like a watch. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, if you were a few seconds off, like if your timekeeping wasn't accurate, you could be a nautical mile away from where you thought you were and you could be bombing civilians instead of the enemy. It was very important that we there's a book about it called the book is called Longitude, and you know it tells you how time is involved in figuring out navigation, which started on the ocean, you know, and figuring out where your boat was in the ocean, but it's all it's all based on time. And now it's all totally irrelevant because we have GPS in our pocket, but you know, I have a piece of World War II history on my wrist. That's which is cool. In my opinion, the coolest watch on the earth.
Right.
Yeah, wait, so is it harder to make a 24-hour rotation then? Like, why is that? Is it just harder to make or why is it more rare?
It's really not that hard to make. It's just different, you know? Yeah. It takes some getting used to. Like, when you look at this watch and on our, for people that are just listening, it's vorticwatches.com/military. It's our military edition. There's a whole website about it. It's awesome. But if you look at this watch, when the hour hand is down at the bottom, that normally would look like 6 o'clock, you know, 6 p.m. Right now, for me, even though it's about that time, it's almost all the way around. And so for me, when it's 12 noon, it looks like it's 6 o'clock, but because 12 is all the way down where six is.
Yeah.
And so it takes a little bit of getting used to, but especially for people in the military or, you know, people that use 24-hour time, that's really functional and it's really nice to have. And I think for most of my customers, it's just different, you know, and it's rare. And when you buy a watch, you know, that's cool. That's another thing.
So do you wind that up every day?
Yeah. So this is one of my daily wear watches. And so I wind it. These ones keep time for about 2 days when you wind it fully. So I in general, I wind it every morning. But the cool thing about manually wound watches is you just wind them whenever you wear them. So if you have a few watches, you just wind this watch in the morning when you put it on, you set the time, and then you're good to go.
So you wind it. So it's like there's like a main spring, right? I was reading a little bit about it. I was a little confused, and so I'm looking for some clarity. So do you wind it, and then is the spring designed to just release itself like at a certain speed so that it keeps seconds, you know, the same, you know what I mean? What I'm trying to say, like,
totally. So think about it like so there's a main spring, like you said, you use the right. So there's a main spring that is rolled up. It almost looks like it's in something resembling like a donut. And so it's all rolled up in there, and the spring slowly releases its power, going from potential energy in the spring to kinetic energy into the balance wheel, which if you look at an old watch that's a manually wound watch, it's got a big old wheel that ticks back and forth. And in general, this is very much a generalization, but in general, one back and forth is 1 second. And the rest of the gear system controls how fast that balance wheel ticks back and forth. And there's lots of other moving parts in there, and it's a very complicated little engine, but it's built to do one thing, which is just as accurately as possible tell time. And so think of that spring as though it were a battery in your electric car. So right now, if you hit the gas and you go really fast, you're burning a bunch of power from that battery really, really quickly. But if you just kept your foot at the exact level, like you were on cruise control, and you pulled the exact same amount of power constantly for 24 hours, that would be regulating the watch, and you're just very slowly releasing the energy from the battery, in this case the spring, into the drive of the rest of the engine, which in this case is the watch that's simply ticking and telling time.
Mm. Okay. So does it start to slow down towards the end of its like winding cycle, I guess? Like, does it start to slow down a little bit, or how do you know when to switch it or wind it up?
Yeah. So great question. So when, if you imagine that battery or the spring inside the watch, when it's almost out of power, so it's almost totally unfurled, or it's released all of the energy that's stored up in that spring that you wind up, it starts to not have enough energy to get the wheel to tick all the way back and forth. And it's a little bit counterintuitive, but when it doesn't have enough power, it can't get all the way to one side and all the way to the other, which makes the watch tell time faster, because the hand is able to just freely move, and it's just moving faster because it's not taking as much time to have that full count of one Mississippi back and forth. So it's like it's ticking a lot faster because it's not getting enough energy to fully tick from one side to the other. And so, yes, when your watch is almost out of energy, it doesn't tell time as accurately. And we tell our customers to, if they want to tell time accurately, to keep the watch wound as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole rabbit hole you could go down in watches in general called power reserve. And there are some high-end watches you can buy today, and there are old pocket watches that have a power reserve indicator. And it's basically a very simple battery indicator that tells you, like, hey, you need to wind the watch. Yeah. You know, it's been 24 hours since you've last wound the watch, and that monitors how much power is left in the battery. Modern watches literally monitor how much power is left in the battery. Those old pocket watches, they simply counted the time since you've last wound the watch. And those are called wind indicators. Modern watches, they call them power reserve indicators. And the most modern Swiss watch with a power reserve indicator is usually tens of thousands of dollars, because it's just, it's one of those complications that's just kind of cool. It's totally unnecessary, but awesome.
Yeah.
I just looked it up. It said the first pocket watch was made with this mainspring in 1510 in Germany.
Yep.
Which is just unbelievable. Like, how do you figure that out?
Was it made out of grass or something?
That's crazy. I mean, watchmaking goes back to that era, 1600s. There's old pocket watches. A lot of the times back then, they were trying to solve that longitude problem. They're trying to, you know, calculate longitude and use them for navigation, figure out where they are, and all that kind of stuff. They didn't really become prolific and be used to, you know, make sure you're on time for a meeting or an appointment or something until like the 1800s. And even in the 1800s, like, you had to be fairly wealthy to have a pocket watch. That's probably why they had them, you know, solid gold and stuff like that. By the early 1900s, though, there were so many millions of them being made that they became a lot more prolific. And, you know, it wasn't just the bankers and the lawyers that had them. It was, you know, other people that, if you needed to know what time it was and you were on the go, you had a pocket watch.
I really want to read this longitude book now. It sounds so interesting, like figuring out how watches were used for like navigation. That's insane.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. I mean, it takes you way back to that era of that's how they did it and why they needed to know.
Yeah, it's honestly crazy. Like, I don't think people think about how, like, I don't know, how crazy of a technology that a watch is. It's almost like a compass, I feel like, is also kind of like that same realm where it's like really, I don't know, almost seems like, I don't know, like out of this world type of thing. You know what I mean?
Well, especially when you think of, like, you don't, you know, we just take it for granted, right? Because I can look at my iPhone and it tells me the exact time from a satellite. And so why would I, I mean, a lot of people ask, especially when I started a watch company, it's like, why would you start a watch company? Like, everybody's got an Apple Watch, everybody's got an iPhone, like it tells you the time for much less money. You know, no one's going to wear a watch in X amount of years. And people have been saying that for 100 years, right? Like, they said that about the wristwatch when we transferred from pocket watches to wristwatches. You know, it's just like there's always something like that. And what is interesting to me is because of that, because we take it for granted and because it's still so fascinating, watches are a luxury. You know, I sell something you don't need for thousands of dollars. And that is really cool because all my customers are awesome. You know, my customers are entrepreneurs and small business owners, and they're buying something that they don't need, which is a luxury purchase. So it's an emotional purchase. So my marketing can be really fun and like, yeah. You know,
true.
You don't need this. So I'm not selling you on the features and stuff. I'm saying, hey, it's a piece of American history. That's really cool that you can have something that all your other watch friends can't buy. Anyone can buy a Rolex, but to have an old pocket watch that's truly one of a kind that was built in America 100 years ago and put it on your wrist, that's awesome. That really stands out. Yeah. It's a conversation piece. So 100%. I think in general, that's why people buy watches, but that's definitely why my customers buy Vortec watches.
But yeah. Like, I feel like it could be a necessity too, in the right case, because let's say we have no power. How are you going to be able to find the time? Or maybe you're just backpacking somewhere with zero electricity and like nothing for like hundreds of miles. Like, I guess apparently you can use it for navigation. So there you go.
Yep.
True.
Yeah. And that's the analog way to look at it. And I do have, you know, especially with Colorado Watch Company, you know, since they're automatics and they wind as you move, and they're made in America and built to last a lifetime. Like, those are things where, yeah, power grid goes out, you're backpacking in the middle of nowhere, Colorado, with no satellite, anything, you at least know what time it is. And yep. You got that thing, and that's going to, you know, that's going to survive an EMP. So you're good.
Yep. Exactly.
That actually is.
There's definitely scenarios where anything with a battery, anything that's controlled by electricity, anything that gets its information from satellites, it could all be wiped out in a second. And I'll tell you what, the watch that's on my wrist, I mean, this functioned and was made in 1942 and it's still going. There's no way you're going to touch it. I mean, it's going to outlive me for sure. 100%.
That is actually, that puts it into light how valuable it is, because it's like my iPhone, everybody knows their phone is going to be in the trash someday. I mean, most of the stuff.
I mean, it dies every day.
Oh, exactly. You know, exactly.
We've all had that scenario where the iPhone dies, you know, 11 PM. You're like, oh, how do I get home?
Yeah. Like, you a know? Watch is one of the only things that's like a pocket watch is one of the only things that is like set in stone, like in modern day, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm trying to think of something else that's like
an old
permanent.
Car, like an old car too.
Yeah, but even then though, like a watch is so much more like, I mean, not simple. Obviously, it's very like complicated.
Yeah, you can't rewind the car. Yeah,
but like a watch is just, I don't know. It's just crazy system to where it's like built to last, and it's just, I feel like it would give you confidence. It would give me confidence if I was rocking like a genuine pocket watch. I'm like, okay, this is gonna be good through an EMP, through an earthquake. I mean, is it waterproof, or would it cause problems if it got underwater?
Yeah, our watches are waterproof. We say water resistant because you know, nothing's ever waterproof. But yeah, we make mechanical things that aren't going to be an issue in any of those those scenarios. And that's like for Vortec, you know, it's less. That's less of the mission. You know, we're preserving American history, so it's not about being rugged and surviving those kind of things. It will, in general, but for Colorado Watch Company, you know, those watches are made in right here in Colorado, and they're made to last a lifetime, and they're made to be fixed. You know, if you break it, it's okay. You send it back to us, we fix it. You definitely would not throw it away and just buy a new one. I would not ever make something like that. That doesn't feel right to me.
My grandpa had a pocket watch, and when I held it, it was like super heavy. It was still in the case and everything. Maybe the case was the heavy part. Do you find that your watches are heavier than the normal watch because it has that pocket watch kind of weight?
Yeah, I mean, the movements, all the gears and everything inside are dense in general. Certainly more dense than like a quartz or a battery powered, you know, modern watch. They are slightly heavier than an Apple Watch, just for a direct comparison. However, when you hold an old pocket watch, most of the weight is from the silver or the gold or the platinum that is the outside case. There's a lot of metal on those things on the outside. So that's it's much lighter than, you know, your grandpa's pocket watch. I'm taking, you know, imagine for a second, I'm taking the face of it, the hands and all the gears and everything. I'm cutting the inside out and just using the guts of that pocket watch. So all the metal on the outside and the glass on the front is all gone. And we're replacing everything on the outside. And we use about half titanium, like half our watches are titanium, so they're pretty light. And then half the watches are steel. Some people like a heavy watch. So I, you know, we have steel and we have bronze for people that like a big heavy watch. And then for people that just want a pocket watch on the wrist and they think it's cool, but they want it to be lighter, titanium is perfect for that. And also built to last a lifetime. Titanium is awesome.
Do you have people that request like gold or silver or anything like that? Or like even like request different stones in it?
Yeah. We get requests for all that stuff all the time. We have not made a Vortec watch or any watches for that matter out of precious metals of any kind. It involves a whole different manufacturing process. You know, you have to...
Okay. Right.
You have to get the machine set up so that you can capture all the extra gold that you're cutting off when we're making the part.
Oh, true. Yeah.
Very expensive, in my opinion, not worth it.
Mm-hmm. I can't just use a broom for that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a little tough. So we haven't done it yet. There are people that can obviously make, you know, solid gold watches and stuff like that, but that's less of our customer and less of our brand. So yeah, we haven't done it yet. I wouldn't say we might ever do it, you know, but we haven't done it yet.
We'll see. Awesome. So I got a question. Earlier you said you're selling something that people want, not need, aka a luxury. How, for all of our business people out there, how is that better than selling something that people need, or what's different? You know what I mean? You said the marketing can be more fun. Can you dive in a little deeper and maybe give some
good question
pros and cons to that?
Yeah. So one of the best definitions of luxury comes from Bernard Arnault, who is the founder of LVMH. I think the fourth or fifth richest man in the world at this point. And when you own Louis Vuitton and the 30 other brands in that, you know, massive conglomerate, you know a thing or two about luxury. And he defines it as, you know, what does this say about you? What does this purchase say about you? You're voting with your wallet for the thing that you want, and you're walking through life wearing, or in that case, you know, holding the Birkin bag or the Louis Vuitton bag that you've always wanted. It's that emotional purchase where it's not about premium anything. It's not about being better, like keeping for watches. It's not about keeping time better or, you know, having all these features that everybody wants. No one's comparing my watch to another watch and comparing the price and the features and all of those like specs from a Vortec watch to a Rolex and making a decision whether they want one or the other. They are simply looking at my product as a standalone item and deciding emotionally whether they want that or not. And so it's easier to do the marketing for that kind of thing because I don't have to compare myself and my brand to anything. I don't have to keep up with what my competitors are doing. I don't have competitors. Nobody really does what I do. And so that in itself is just more fun because when you boil it down, I think Gary Vee said it, document, don't create. So I run a manufacturing company. Most watch companies and most manufacturing companies end up being marketing companies where they're just creating content. They're creating taglines. They're constantly creating these fictional stories and these made up ideas to try to convince you to buy that thing instead of their competitor's thing. All I have to do is flip the camera around and document what I do here. And I say, hey, look, we're making watches today. We're cutting metal today. We're restoring pocket watches today. I'm documenting everything I'm doing. I'm not creating any kind of crazy marketing stuff. I'm just saying, hey, this is what we do. And if you want to be part of this story, then go to vortecwatches.com and we'll get one on your wrist. It's so much more fun. It's so much easier. And at the same time, there's a lot more margin in the luxury world to pay for all that, you know, content creation, storytelling, and branding. And yeah, I mean, that's to me, that whole definition of like, what does this watch say about you and how you make decisions is just so much, it's so much more interesting than trying to compete on any specs and compare yourself to other competitors.
Yeah. So what does marketing look like for you then? Is it strictly social media base? Like, where are you marketing this to find the right clientele?
Yeah, we start with long form. So we make YouTube videos all the time about basically how it's made, stories of American history, documentation. Yeah, just like this, you know, things that my customers would be interested in, like stories about how the pocket watches were made 100 years ago. You know, lots of videos on our YouTube channel about us like cutting metal and all that kind of stuff. I also document my journey and talk to my, not really competitors, but my friends in the watch industry and in the industry of American manufacturing. I have a podcast called American Dreamers. And so we just talk about how hard it is to make things in the United States. And my customers think that's fun and interesting. And so we start with long form, make all that content for YouTube, and then we chop it up and use all the B-roll and extra content for short form on all the social media channels and send the content or send the traffic from social back to our website or back to YouTube for the ongoing education. And all of that I do in a funnel to get your email address. So almost 80% of my revenue comes from email marketing. And if you can imagine, you know, people don't click a Facebook ad or click on a YouTube video, go to vorticwatches.com and pull the trigger on a $5,000 watch, you know, while they're, you know, laying in bed. That happens periodically, but most of the time my customers sign up for the email list or they click follow on or subscribe and they follow along for months. They're looking at all the watches we make. And then finally one really speaks to them and they pull the trigger. So the way I do that best is I send one email a week and I call it the weekly roundup. And we make, like you said earlier, Braden, we make one watch a day, the watch of the day. And every week I send an email and I say, you know, hey, it's Friday. Here's five pictures of five watches that we made this week.
That's cool.
Which one do you want? Awesome. And that email list over the last 5 years has grown from a few thousand to now 50,000 people get that email every Friday.
Wow.
And every time I hit send on that email, we make money. So it's that simple and also not that simple at the same time.
What about people wanting to convert? Like, what's your percentage of customers that send you a pocket watch that maybe came from a family member?
Totally. We do one of those a week on average, about 50 a year.
Okay.
We get requests for that all the time. That's a very organic process for us. We don't run ads for that. It's just, we just talk about what we do. I do podcasts like this. We do all the stuff we talked about. And then people reach out. I probably get 5 requests for that service per week. And then, you know, once everything gets distilled out, it's usually about one person per week on average that actually pulls the trigger and goes through with it. That service is thousands of dollars, so it's not for everyone. And obviously we can't convert every watch that was ever made.
Right.
And so yeah, once we get through that process, that's, you know, to me, that's probably 10% of our revenue is that process and that service, but it's fully organic. And those are the coolest customers and the coolest stories that we have. So we spend a lot of time on that process and try to make it as, you know, interactive as possible.
Yeah. Do you have to get if they request to have a conversion, do they have to send in the watch so you can check it out and figure out if you can actually do it? And then,
yeah, it starts by sending us an email with pictures and the story. You know, this was my great uncle's watch or grandma's watch or something like that. And they send us pictures of the front and back. Usually I can tell if we can do it from just the pictures. But then we have a product that's a hidden product on our website that I send them. I mean, they pay $20 and I ship them a box that has an AirTag in it so I can track everything to and from. They put grandpa's pocket watch in the box. It has custom foam and like a little pamphlet of like, these are the options that we do. And we call that service Convert Your Watch, and we make it a white glove service because we only do 50 a year. So we want you to feel special, and we send you what it's going to look like, what your options are and all that stuff. And then we track the package on the way back to us so that the pocket watch, it's a family heirloom, is safe the whole way. And then once we get it, we triple verify that we can actually do it. And then we start the work. And the process to do that usually takes 4 to 6 months. And we're not working on the watch the whole time. We just, you know, we have 20 or 30 of them in process at all times. So, you're just kind of in the safe, you know, in the queue, if that makes sense.
Yeah, wow. For sure. That's so cool. It's an interesting process.
Yeah, for sure. Talking like alternate revenue, do you see like Colorado Watch Company and Fortic as one? Like, is that one company right now? Or do you kind of just see them differently? And like, if so, like, what's like the percentage revenue from each? Like, which is kind of leading the other?
Totally. So I built Vortic into a C Corp so that I can have multiple brands and sub entities under one conglomerate or parent company, if you will. So Vortic Inc. owns Vortic Watch Company and Colorado Watch Company as two brands currently. I plan to acquire or merge with, you know, different suppliers too, so I can roll them up under one, you know, parent company and have a little bit more vertical integration. And I also plan to acquire or build multiple brands and have more than just two brands sometime in the future. And like I said, I'm running a manufacturing company, so we can be the backbone for, I mean, I could run 10 brands at this point, right, with the infrastructure I set
that's
up.
Huge.
Which is super fun, and that's the long term. And you know, I'm in full hustle mode. I got lots of room left to go, and there has never been a better time to manufacture a product in the United States. So I gotta go. Like, the momentum we have right now is so fun. But to answer your question, Vortic, you know, if you do the math, it's pretty simple math. You know, let's call it 300 watches a year at roughly $5,000 a piece. That's $1.5 million a year. I think for Vortic, we'll cap out at roughly $2 million a year, even if we like max out everything.
Okay.
Which is great. You know, for many people, that's the American dream. You know, I'm running a 7-figure business, paying myself 6 figures, and having, you know, a handful of employees, and I own the building. So like, for most people, that's awesome. For me, that's boring. Like, it's small. And so I'm going big, and Colorado Watch Company is big. We're trying to get to 10 million in revenue as fast as we can. I'll probably get somewhere between 4 and 6 this year. Wow. Meaning it's, you know, two to three times as big as Vortic already, right off the bat.
Well,
and going to 10 as fast as I can.
We talk about the marketing on that for a second,
yeah,
because that's not going to be the same marketing, because it's not as much of the storytelling or luxury, or I guess it still is the luxury, but I think the story is going to be a little different because these are now just American made watches. Like, what's your sales pitch for just the Colorado Watch Company?
Well, first, when you go to coloradowatchcompany.com, right there, dead center, it says the most American watch at scale. So I think there are millions of people in the world, not just in America, that want to buy American made stuff. And we are the only one. If you want an American made watch for roughly $1,000,
crazy.
That's it, right? It's me and Shinola at this point, you know, and Shinola is a great option and they're a great competitor, but you know, there's not a lot of options there. If you want to support a company making stuff in America and you want to watch, and you want a good like entry level, you know, I don't want to call it affordable because it's, you know, it's still $1,000. It's a lot, but a more attainable, you know, price point. That's just us. So I think our value proposition is really strong. To start. And then to answer your question though about marketing is paid traffic. So for Vortic, I've done mostly organic content creation. We're getting really good at it. I have in-house everything at this point. And so we're great at creating awesome content. And now I can pour fuel behind that content and pay for advertising on Meta and Google and get a million eyeballs on this beautiful content that I've been creating for years. And so that's the big way is just paid traffic. I know exactly how much it costs me to get a customer,
right,
on all those platforms. I have an ad agency. It's called Weekend Digital. They've helped build massive companies before. We have a whole marketing plan involving paid traffic and influencers and affiliates and all kinds of awesome stuff that we're getting into, but it takes money to make money. So, you know, I've been raising money for that purpose. And that purpose is spending, you know, probably $100,000 a month on Facebook ads for a while.
Wow.
And that's exciting to me. You know, that's a shitload of credit card points if you do it right. So that's the next journey.
Yeah. Wow. And like, what's most insane to me is like, it seems like you've just done everything right. It's all just kind of happened, because this literally could have just been like a hobby. Like, someone's hobby could have been fixing up old watches, maybe making them into real wristwatches. And like, you didn't like stop there or anything. You had like the whole vision, and then you went manufacturing, and then you created Colorado Watches, and you're not even done yet. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
How did you like, can we kind of go back to square one? What was your job that allowed you to buy the warehouse and like actually really go full gear into this?
Yeah. So thank you. Everything you just said was validating, and I feel grateful for the words you just said. So I appreciate you. However, it's been 10 years. You know, that's a long time. That's my entire adult life. I started the company, had the idea while studying at Penn State. You know, I was 21. Tyler and I launched the business out of my garage here in Colorado right after school. And at that time, first 2 years, running Vortic, I also had a full-time job for Walmart in logistics. They called it logistics engineering. And so I reported to the home office in Benton, and I ran logistics for logistics engineering, basically renovating distribution centers and trying to figure out how to get the packages from the suppliers like Procter & Gamble to the Walmart stores faster, more efficiently, cheaper, things like that. Mm-hmm. That was my job for 2 years out of school before I quit and ran Vortic full time. And to answer your question, I mean, it's 10 years is a long time. So compound interest. I was lucky. I bought a house in 2014 with my first corporate salary. I graduated school with an industrial engineering degree, made, I think, $65,000 right out of school, which was good, you know, for an engineering job. And I was lucky enough to buy a house for $178,000, three bed, two bath, right? That'll make you cry. Yeah. Three bed, two bath condo here in Fort Collins, Colorado for $178,000. Today it's worth $450,000 probably. And so between compound interest, equity, having a low interest rate on that became a rental property that was used for collateral on all my business loans. And a lot of it goes back to what they call OPM or other people's money. So I've raised over $2 million in equity capital, you know, Shark Tank style from investors over the last, you know, 5 years really is when I started raising that kind of capital. And then I've also used every known source of debt known to man, every single SBA loan that exists, I've had and I've used. And that's how I got this building. You know, it's called an SBA 504 loan, where the federal government backs a loan so you could buy commercial real estate for your business at a low interest rate. I got the EIDL loans during COVID that were 3.7% interest for 30 years. That's basically a mortgage loan for your business. Yeah. It was awesome.
That's not bad.
We did the payroll protection program that was a, you know, free grant. If you basically, you know, if you kept all of your employees employed during the pandemic, then you got a grant from the government to say thanks for not laying people off. And I like to say I accidentally built a pandemic-proof and tariff-proof business. And that's what you get when you make things in America.
Yeah.
We survived all of that stuff because we weren't reliant on anything outside of our walls and outside of our country. So that all worked out. And I think to sum it all up, Oliver, my dad says this mostly about golf. I'd rather be lucky than good. And I've gotten pretty good at a lot of these things, but there was a few times in my life where I got really freaking lucky. And I'm so grateful to be here and be an entrepreneur. And that's why I call myself a dreamer. Like, the American dream is alive and well, and it's so fun.
100%.
But only if you do the right thing. You know, There was a lot of times in that 10 years where I, like, if I went down the wrong path, I would not be on this podcast right now. It's a journey. It's a hustle. It's a grind. But I would wake up and do it again every day. And I still do because, man, it's fun. I wouldn't have it any other way. And I'm totally unemployable at this point. Like, if you tried to tell me what to do with my time during the day now, like if I worked a normal job, absolutely not. That would be awful. I just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Speaking of your time and what you do, I kind of want to dive into, like, how do you manage all of this? And if you don't mind sharing, what's your daily schedule? I think a lot of people struggle with getting a routine, especially if they're working for themselves. You're relying on yourself. Like, you have to do, nobody's telling you to do anything. You have to do it yourself. So how do you stay motivated?
Yeah. So biggest thing I've learned in motivation is I don't have to do anything. I get to do everything. And that's all mindset, and that's mental health. And the best thing I've learned to protect my mental health is to protect and grow my physical health. So I go to the gym. I'm at least 5 days a week. I take, like this morning, I didn't have time for the gym, but I took a walk with my wife and our two little kids. We have a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old. And so we walked around our neighborhood with the dogs and just walked in the sunshine. And, you know, it was like perfect day today. So move your body in some way, you know, in the morning. That's what I've learned. It really helps with just lighten up my brain and keeping myself active. And then I love the concept of time blocking. My first manager in my first job introduced me to the concept, but it's like we all lose energy and focus after about 60 to 90 minutes of doing the same thing. So I never schedule a meeting or a work session or a, you know, creative session for more than 90 minutes. And my whole calendar is like 45 to 90 minute blocks where I do one thing, I finish it, and then I move on to the next one. because you burn out in 60 to 90 minutes and you're not as effective. And so I take a little break in between. And then, I mean,
you're pretty soon then.
yeah. We want to wrap this thing up. But you know, all that, and an amazing support system. So when I first started, you know, it was just myself and my business partner, Tyler. But I was also, you know, in my early 20s, so I had a lot less energy, or a lot more energy, a lot less stuff. You know, I was single. I didn't have any obligations. I could take a lot of risk, you know, so it was all good. I was just all in. Today, you know, with the infrastructure I have, I mean, I have an assistant, I have 10 other employees. Like, again, I don't have to do anything. The business can run itself, and I work every day to get out of the way. And they call it, if your business passes the bus test. So if I get hit by a bus, what happens? Yeah. Right. And so for that, it's systems and processes and documentation. And okay, you know, everybody in this meeting, like, think about the next time we do this, do we need a meeting about this? And can we all write this down so that if this ever happens again, now we have a playbook that now we know how to solve this problem the next time, and we don't need five people. One person could just be like, oh yeah, this is what we did last time. We can totally solve this problem. We don't even need to pull RT or the executives back into it. And all of that starts with me, right? All the momentum, all the ideas, all the energy of the company, all the systems, all the processes, all the next things, you know, what are we doing next? Where are we going next? That all starts with me. And so I have to bring my A game every day. And that starts, you know, right here. And I got to be mentally fit and ready for that every day. And those are managing my time blocking my time, you know, doing the hard thing first, working out, taking care of my physical health, all that stuff, and then surrounding yourself with just badass people that do the hard work and continue to show up every single day. I would not be here if I didn't have the support structure and the employees and, you know, the amazing wife that I have. Lindsay's also an entrepreneur, so she gets it. And when I get home late tonight, she'll be like, how was your day? You know, instead of where were you? So having that is also very helpful.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Wait, so what does she do then? You said she's an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Lindsay has always worked in helping female entrepreneurs, at this point, mostly moms, grow their businesses. So she specializes in, if you are a mom entrepreneur, typically working from home, she's a coach and a consultant to help take your business from, you know, six or seven figures to eight figures. That's her specialty is awesome. Operations and systems and growth. And it's mostly for people that run online businesses and work remote, which is awesome. Cause you know, as a mom, you know, she's a mom of two of our little kids, and she can work 20 or 30 hours a week and accomplish more than even I can with the systems and everything that she built. And so now she gets to teach other people how to do that.
Awesome.
That's cool. Yeah. That's amazing, dude. Well, what else do we want to cover today, man? Oliver, you got anything right now?
Yeah, maybe we can hit some final questions or a final question. I have one. I'm in New York City right now. And just walking Fifth Avenue, there's a ton of watch shops. And I believe you are currently just online with both companies. Would you ever consider any brick and mortar establishment? Like maybe if you scale?
Yeah. So for Vortic, it doesn't really make sense to do retail stores since we only make a few hundred watches a year. But for Colorado Watch Company, that is part of the plan. I think at least 25, scaling to probably 40% of our sales and our revenue will come from wholesale, is what I call that. And that's a whole nother animal. I'm hiring a salesperson to literally go to those stores and sell watches. And I wouldn't sell to those stores on Fifth Avenue, the big watch stores and those things. That's a hard sell. And they like a lot of things, those stores are owned by the huge conglomerate that also own the watch companies. And so it's almost impossible to get in. But there are roughly 400 to 500 family-owned, like mom and pop jewelry stores and watch stores all around just America. And so that's my first goal, is get into as many of those stores as possible. And let's say I have 200 stores that all have, you know, 10 watches in it. That's 2,000 watches out there getting introduced to people all the time at all of those 200 stores in 200 different locations around the country. So that's the first goal, is to, you know, get into that kind of smaller entry level, you know, retail standpoint. And then once I do that, then I'll skip those big stores because, like I said, it's really hard to get into them. And I'll go international distribution. And there are some pretty big and well-known, you know, watch stores in all the other countries that I think, and I've proven this a couple times with a few conversations, would like to sell something that's made in USA.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to ask. Like, do they see that as a luxury? Like, oh, this is made in the US.
Yeah, so most of Asia thinks that American made is really cool. You know, if you're a luxury consumer in China, you don't want made in China. You want made in America. It's kind of the opposite. You know, it's kind of interesting. And made in USA is really popular in China, Japan, and Australia for whatever reason. There's a huge following of like American watches and American stuff in Australia. And in like Japan, for instance, American bourbon, you know, American whiskey. There's Japanese whiskey that's fantastic, but if you're Japanese, the American whiskey is cool. You know, it's different. It's fun. And so I think there's massive opportunities in Asia, especially. And so that's probably where we'll go first. Europe already, you know, if you live in Europe in general, you believe that a Swiss watch is the best watch and you want a Swiss made watch because it's made just down the road from you or whatever. So that's probably where I'll go last because they care less in general. It's a massive generalization, but you know what I'm saying?
Right.
But, you know, once you leave America, I mean, we only have 360 some million people here. I mean, yeah, there's billions of people in Asia. And so now my numbers of like, I'm trying to make 10,000 watches a year. I mean, shoot, I could sell 10,000 watches a year just statistically. Like there's billions of consumers. Yeah. So
it's a good problem.
It's a great mindset. Though. Yeah.
Yeah. That's when the numbers, and that's, you know, my first job, guys, was door to door selling paint jobs. Like I worked for College Works Painting in college. And that's before I knew it was a multi-level marketing company and what network marketing was and all that stuff. I had no idea that I was part of a pyramid. It ended up being a good thing for me because I worked my way up the pyramid and I learned a lot and it was so, so fun. But it started by literally door to door, knocking on doors and saying, hey, I'd like to paint your house this summer to make money. My first boss said, every no gets you one step closer to the next yes. And every time you get a door slammed in your face, well, go knock on another one, right? And when you boil it all down, that's one of the things that keeps me going. It's like for Vortic, we only make 300 watches a year. I could literally go door to door in the city of Denver here in Colorado and sell watches for like a week. And I could sell 100% of my annual inventory just knocking on doors in like the high-end neighborhoods in Colorado. Yeah. I'm not going to do that because it's much easier to sit here at my desk and just run some Facebook ads. Mm-hmm. But that, I think, is a fun way to look at your business is like, if shit hit the fan and you had to just hustle and do it all yourself, you could totally do it, you know, and that'd be absolutely fine. And honestly, in some ways, it'd be easier and be kind of fun. I'd be fit. I'd be tan, you know?
Yeah.
I'd be making all kinds of new friends. I'd be seeing people in person, which we don't do very much anymore.
It's kind of cool. You can see people's reactions to like live. You can be like,
yeah,
you show them the watch and they're like, whoa, that's crazy. And then you tell them
it'd be weird as hell. It wouldn't work today, you know, because people be like, why are you at my door? Just send me a Facebook ad, kid. Like, what are you doing? But yeah, it would work, you know, if you really had to do it. And I could totally find a way to sell enough watches to feed my family. I'm just going door to door. So if you can do that, then you can do all the much easier things like sitting at your desk running ads.
Yeah. Kind of going in a little bit of a different direction, but still kind of in the same areas, like selling your watches. Is there any copyright or not copyright, I guess legal or patent issues when you're using these old watches? Like if it's Hamilton made or, and I don't know, maybe because it's so old, there's not really any issues there, but have you ever ran into any problems?
Yeah. One of the largest lawsuits in the watch industry was a lawsuit called Hamilton v. Vortic. And I got sued by, I know you just use that as a random example, but I got sued by Hamilton in 2016 is when it started. It was a 6-year legal battle. We almost made it to the Supreme Court. And they accuse, so Hamilton Watch Company now, today, is owned by the Swatch Group, which is the world's largest watch conglomerate, multi-billion dollar international conglomerate in Switzerland. They own Omega, that's their biggest brand, but Hamilton is a brand that they own. And they bought that brand in the 1970s after the pocket watch manufacturing company of Hamilton went out of business in the 1960s in America. And they make modern day Hamilton watches. And so I got accused of trademark infringement and counterfeiting, and they sued Vortic Watch Company, and they sued Robert T. Custer, which is me personally, and dude, I had to defend myself. There was no way around it. It was either defend myself and try to prove that, like, hey, we're just taking pocket watches and upcycling them and turning them into wristwatches, or we shut the whole thing down, because if taking a Hamilton pocket watch and making a wristwatch is illegal, then taking any pocket watch and making a wristwatch of any brand would be illegal, and it would kill the entire business model. To make a long story short, so the lawsuit was called Hamilton v. Vortic. It's all over the internet. There's lots of stories. It's all public because it was a federal lawsuit. We won in 2021, received the in February of 2020. I had my chance to sit with a judge in federal court, took my watch off, handed it to her, told her the whole story. It was just me and a couple attorneys, you know, pleading our case in federal court in Manhattan, in a really cool building, you know, down there in the financial district. Yeah. In Manhattan. It was awesome. And I got my day in court. We told the whole story, and my attorney said, hey, you've never done anything wrong, so just start talking and keep talking, you know, tell your whole story, make sure the judge understands that you're just upcycling. And her name was Judge Nathan, and she wrote a 40-page legal document that is now the law, and it states that taking a pocket watch and turning it into a wristwatch, regardless of the brand, is legal and is okay as long as you properly educate the consumer. That's what trademark law is all about, is you make sure that the customer knows what they're buying. And so we protected the art of upcycling, because it's way bigger than pocket watches. You know, that's right. Now, if you take a Coca-Cola can and you turn it into a lamp and you sell 10,000 of them, Coca-Cola can't sue you because of my lawsuit, which is pretty cool.
Dude, that's actually insane.
And so that's upcycling, and that's, you know, we document, I did a whole like YouTube series on it, and documented the whole story because we won. And so the little guy didn't get, you know, snuffed out, and I got a chance to tell my story, and it's a long one, but it's a good one.
So the reason, you go ahead, Oliver, you had a good question. I feel like
I was going to say, whenever you're selling them, do you have to, like, obviously, yeah, you got to let them know what it is, like, in the title of the product. Is it still a Vortic pocket watch, or is it, like, do you have to say, like, Vortic, Hamilton? Like, do you have to use their name at all?
So from the beginning, first of all, had no idea. So let's zoom out for a second. I think one of the best motivators for entrepreneurs is delusion. I had no idea what it was going to take to run a business. I had no idea about anything about trademark law. I was just like, we're going to take pocket watches, we're going to turn them into wristwatches, we're going to make millions of dollars, it's going to be awesome. And fortunately enough, I still feel that way. And it's like we went through on this whole podcast so far, it's been a freaking roller coaster, but it's awesome. And so I had to learn all that kind of stuff, you know, by just, yeah, getting sued and talking to an attorney and saying, like, okay, well, trademark law and trademark infringement, what they accused you of is all about educating the consumer. And so the only thing we had to do was put a disclaimer on the bottom of the website and the bottom of every product page and in the packaging, like a little card that just said, you know, Vortic and Vortic LLC at that point, Vortic Inc. at this point, is in no way associated with any antique brand you see on the website, such as Hamilton, Elgin, Illinois, whatever. We simply take antique American pocket watches, restore them, and turn them into wristwatches.
Okay.
And so that's, from a legal standpoint, you need a disclaimer. But also, the way we do our marketing, and this was an accident, but the way we do our marketing is we just tell everyone everything. So we just, like, all of the website. I mean, if you go to vorticwatches.com and you scroll down the homepage, like one scroll, it literally says, and it said this 10 years ago, who we are. Those words exactly. Who we are, what we do, why we do it. and it says in very plain English, like, this is who we are. This is where we are. This is what we do. We take pocket watches. We turn them into wristwatches. Everything inside is old. It's original. The brand Hamilton on the dial, or Elgin or Waltham, was printed 100 years ago. And we're just upcycling that and displaying it to you now in a Vortec pocket watch conversion case. And then here's why we do it, and all that kind of stuff. And I learned all that from a book called Building a Story Brand by Don Miller, and another book called Start With Why by Simon Sinek. And those two authors and those two books helped me describe what I do and all that kind of stuff. And like I said, accidentally, you know, protected myself against anyone being confused.
So if you didn't have like that, and so you had the disclaimer like 10 years ago, you said, before the lawsuit, is that,
did you already, we already had a disclaimer.
And that's the reason why you were good and like they didn't shut you down?
Yeah, well, that was one of the reasons. You know, if you have the disclaimer, that's one big reason. If you have, you just do your marketing right and you tell everyone what you do, that's another one that can protect you. Another way we could have defended ourselves from the beginning was simply saying what we do is art. You know, any form of art is protected by the federal government. And so we could have just claimed that these are art, and we could have done that from the start, and with or without a disclaimer and with or without, you know, proper marketing. If it's art, it's typically, you know, okay. And so we did all of that, but we mostly focused on the marketing explanation. We mostly focused on the storytelling, and we just made sure that the judge and everybody involved knew that from the beginning, we are primarily an educational company. Like, I've been teaching my customers what's inside the watch and what's real and what's 100 years old and what's authentic since the beginning. And so my customers were never confused. And a lot of times in those lawsuits, they do studies. So they go like interview 1,000 people on the street and they say like, is this a Vortec watch or is this a Hamilton watch? They didn't do that. But one of the other factors there is if the consumer is like how educated the consumer is. And so if your product is mass market and your consumer is kind of everyone and anyone, that's harder to defend against than what I had, which is my consumer is people who know watches, who are spending thousands of dollars on something on the internet that they've never seen in person. So the amount of effort I have to go through to convince you to buy a watch helped a lot in legally protecting me, because my customers are really educated. You know, they're just like, yeah, I know exactly what I'm buying. Why would I swipe my credit card for $3,000 if I didn't know what I was buying? Of course, this is an old pocket watch made in a wristwatch, you know, come on. So it was a mixture of all of those things. But as you can tell, you know, I also accidentally or had to learn almost everything about trademark law along the way. I'm not an attorney,
yeah,
but I could write a damn good trademark application right now, because yeah. I know exactly how to do it.
So is that one of the things you would consider yourself like lucky, that you just happen to like read those books? And do you consider yourself lucky for that?
Yeah, you could look at it like luck. I look at that particular thing like karma. So I have always done the right thing, and most of the time it's been accidental. You know, I choose the harder path accidentally. I don't know it's going to be the harder path, but like doing things the right way costs more money, takes more time, is more difficult. Mm-hmm. But if you put good in, you get good out. And it's karma, you know. And depending on what you believe, you know, where you fall on religion and the universe and just, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, your beliefs change over time. But for me, I definitely believe in karma, and I'm putting good in every day. And in some of these scenarios, it's coming back at me in a really good way, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like there's like natural karma too, where it's like you do the right thing, it just naturally something good's going to come out of it just by like the things that occurred because of that right action that you did. You know what I mean? Like the consequences of you doing the right thing, I guess in other words, could be called karma, you know? And so that's like an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah. Yep. And it's, you know, the opposite is very true. If you choose to do the wrong thing and you do things that are bad or evil or unethical or, you know, things that could get you put in jail, then when you go to jail, you have no one to blame but yourself. Exactly, it came back.
Yeah. For all of our fellow entrepreneurs out there, people that want to start something, you've clearly done a fantastic job yourself. What is your one last piece of advice you'd give to them?
I think the number one piece of advice I can share with anyone who is, you know, a new entrepreneur or just getting started or wants to get started in entrepreneurship is Don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to ask the dumb questions. You should ask every single question, and you can ask that question now of Google, of ChatGPT. You don't have to.
Yeah.
Back in my day, I had to go find someone and get their phone number and call them and say, hey, have you ever seen this or done this, or how do I get this advice? There is a mountain of information in your pocket, and more importantly, all around you. Like, I think if you can connect with other entrepreneurs like me who have done it and who have seen it, and say, hey, I noticed that you got sued by a big company in your industry. Can you just tell me, like, I'm currently getting sued by a company. Like, how'd you deal with it? Or like, what attorney did you use? Or where do you start? Some of the biggest mistakes, or some of the things that took me the longest or cost me the most, is where I felt embarrassed and I didn't ask for help, or I didn't tell people that I was going through something difficult. And I just tried to figure it out on my own. And there was a hack. There was a, you know, a pill. There was someone right in front of me that could help me massively. And I was either ashamed or embarrassed to ask the stupid question, and I didn't. And I have completely gotten over that now. And now I am asking so many questions, and, you know, I will share my ChatGPT search history with anyone anytime. I'm not ashamed of the questions that I ask the world and the universe and the friends around me, because I'm trying to be a sponge. I'm trying to go faster. I'm trying to keep this momentum that I have and not mess it up. And so I'm asking all those questions all the time. And I would recommend that you do the same.
That's great advice.
Yeah, that's great, dude. And yeah, you can't be afraid of like rejection. It kind of goes back to the door-to-door sales, like you were saying. Like, you can ask questions, and if they're just like kind of like a, I don't know, if they're like rude about it or whatever, who cares? You know what I mean? Ask another one. Like, you can't take it personally. You just got to keep going. You know what I mean?
No stupid questions, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
No stupid questions, and we're all human, you know?
Yeah.
And I think most people genuinely enjoy helping other people. Mm-hmm. So most people that I ask questions of, and even back in those days when I'm knocking on doors and I'm talking to people, I mean, I used to have people say like, hey, you know what? I don't need my house painted, but my cousin was just saying that he needs his painted. He lives like six blocks over. Mm-hmm. Let me give you his address. I'm telling him I sent you. You know, like, that didn't happen very often. But there is a certain subset of the population, and it's a much greater percentage of entrepreneurs, especially, that get a lot of joy and value out of giving back and helping people. And you can see that all over the internet on, you know, some of those really viral, like, Instagrams, like the guy who interviews really successful entrepreneurs, like, that guy's just awesome. But like, you know, those people, those people that he interviews, you know, they're just being asked on the street, and then they just drop these nuggets, and it's just like, they have all this information in their head, and you can see the joy on their face when they're like, oh my gosh, like, this is actually going to really help someone.
Yeah.
I wish he would put out like a video of like them reacting to, like, I'm sure at some point he shows them his Instagram account and like shows the millions of people that follow and all the people that are going to get help from that thing they just said. I want like the reaction montage of like all those people. Like, oh my God, like, I didn't realize you were famous. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think so many people genuinely want to help, and that's sitting right there. But if you don't ask the question, it's going to stay in their head.
Yeah, man. Well, RT, man, I really appreciate you coming. Really appreciate you making the time. You're such a nice guy. I'm really happy you beat the case. I think I'm going to cop one someday. Hopefully when I, you know, get enough money, I'll buy a watch. But yeah, it was great talking to you.
Hey,
everybody, that was RT Custer. Go check out his website. Do you want to shout out like the social media page or something?
Yeah, totally. So if you want to connect with me, my best platform is Instagram. It's RT Custer, CUSTER. And then my websites are vorticwatches.com. That's VORTIC watches.com and coloradowatchcompany.com. And if you forget all of that, we are the only one. Google Colorado Watch Company. You'll find all of it.
Nice, dude. All right. Awesome. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will see you guys next episode.